line of friends that were creeping down the rubble-strewed hallways, a man even smaller than J.B. Dix. Not even a man, really, if manhood was determined by chronological age. The youth was 16 years old, 5 feet 4 inches tall, and might have weighed 110 pounds soaking wet. His face was shockingly white, not flesh tone, but ghost pale, with numerous scars on the chin and cheeks. At first glance, no one saw the scars. They were too busy peering at Jack's eyes, which were a blood-red crimson, twin rubies set in a grim visage, fringed by bangs of pure white hair. The long mane cascaded across his narrow shoulders like a waterfall. Hidden on his person, Jack had several leaf-bladed throwing knives, their hilts taped for a perfect balance. The style of leather and camo canvas jacket he'd favored and worn for so long had tiny shards of razored steel sewn into the lining and sleeves, strategically torn in the most easy-to-reach places. The young albino didn't need to worry about using a blaster when he had access to his knives, but a heavy, well-used, and well-maintained Colt Python was fastened to one of his skinny legs, just in case. So many weapons were a necessary evil in the Deathlands. Ryan didn't share JB's burning fascination with hardware. His own personal arsenal was simple and neat. A 9mm Sig Sauer P226 pistol was at his side, holstered and safe. The blaster held 15 full-metal jacketed bullets and came with a built-in baffle silencer. Over one shoulder, Ryan had looped his walnut-stocked Steyr SSG-70 bolt-action rifle, which fired 10 7.62mm rounds and came with a laser image enhancer and a starlight night scope. Ryan also had two bladed weapons, a large 18-inch Panga strapped to his left hip, and a flensing knife hidden away at the small of his back. Various autoloads and other clips of ammunition, along with a talent for the archaic art of hand-to-hand combat, made Ryan a dangerous two-legged killing machine. Unlike many of the other hard men of the Deathlands, Ryan Cotter was also a thinking man, with a capacity for compassion, if allowed by his foes to grant such gifts. But rarely was he given such an option. Dean looked into the dimness of the open stairwell.
We going up?
Yeah. Christy, grab that torch over there.
The woman complied, hefting the canvas-tipped piece of wood into the air.
Still got some life in it, I think. Must have been left behind when those stickies were down here before.
J.B. stubbed out the end of the cigar and placed it in a pocket, then used the lighter to ignite the end of the stick, proving the crusty torch indeed still worked.
Okay, let's go.
Ryan took the point, followed by the others. Christy was close to Ryan and J.B., shining the light up into the dark for a long span of minutes, until a new presence joined them unexpectedly on the winding staircase.
Fresh meat.
Christy's left arm was bent painfully back, and the makeshift torch was snatched from her hand. Red embers flew as the lighted head of the stolen torch was shoved into a cloth bag, and instantly the world of the hospital stairwell went black. Doc's cry was lost in the new images that seemed to swirl out of the night of forgetfulness and come alive in his mind, taking him back to another time. Chicago, Illinois Redoubt, 1998. As a slender young man, Theophilus Algernon Tanner had spent many a lazy summer afternoon swimming in the nearby Connecticut River to escape the surprisingly damnable Vermont heat. The summer of his 12th birthday was humid and sticky, and made one almost yearn for the sub-zero cold snaps of the long winter months. Never much for active sport or physical activity, the boy did enjoy spending hours in the water, sometimes practicing a clumsy dog paddle, other times just content to float gently on his back, his face directed upward at the cloud-filled skies. Theo rarely paid attention to the sky. His eyes were usually closed, his keen young mind lost in thought, and as adrift as his lanky preteen body. Since the river was quite still at the point where Theo liked to relax and play, he was able to idly doze in this floating position, cooled by the water from the back, while warmed from the front by the sun overhead. But this day, the water suddenly sucked him down, holding him helpless beneath the surface by an unexpected undertow. Young Theo's eyes popped open in shock, horrified and confused to discover the blue sky above had been replaced by a swirling mass of dim blue and brown, and in his ears was a terrible roaring as his eardrums were assaulted by the onrush of water now enveloping his helplessly prone body. He scrambled madly, trying to pull himself back to the world above. His arms pumped and his legs kicked, and still he stayed in place. Almost as if he were being held down by some elemental water demon who'd claimed him as a sacrifice to the river gods. Then the grip was loosened, and the boy was able to thrust himself free of the water and into the air, where his lungs gratefully sucked in life-giving oxygen in between bouts of coughing up the stomach full of the Connecticut River he'd swallowed.
Look here, Albert. We done come upon Algy Tanner.
Right where you'd expect to find him.
What do you mean?
Floating on the water, just like any old kind of pond scum.
Bullies. Even as an adult, he would still remember their names. One had been dubbed Merlin by his parents, the other a more pedestrian Albert. With his keen intellect, slight build, and strange hair color, even as a teen, the sandy brown had already started to transform into the eventual gray he would possess as an adult, Theo was used to being the butt of humor from the less gifted. And while he never took such pranks meekly, he wasn't the type to dwell upon concepts of revenge. As a result, he'd spent much of his youth isolated. Luckily, he hadn't minded solitude. In fact, he'd grown fond of keeping his own counsel. Isolated. Yet he could still hear snippets of conversation swirling around him, like the blue water and brown silt of the Connecticut River of his youth.
Any diseases we shall be worried about?
Theo didn't recognize that voice, although it did sound vaguely like Merlin's.
Negative. Cryosleep kept him on ice. Nothing to fear. At least nothing from his era. Still, I hope everyone in this operating room has had his shots.
Bullies again? Theo couldn't be sure.
No, I'd say he'd be the one we should be concerned with. There are bugs floating in the air. Our guest has never had the joy of breathing.
Blood pressure's high. Pulse rate's racing overtime.
That's to be expected. Keep an eye on the lower numbers. If they go up another 10 points, let me know. They should be dropping soon.
Negative on the drop, sir. Top and bottom are climbing to the rafters.
Damn it. He's going into cardiac arrest. We need the cart!
Can we contain him?
I don't know.
I don't want to hear I don't know. I repeat, can we contain him?
I'm trying. We're trying.
This is the first successful trawl of a human subject. A subject we chose most carefully. This is no unthinking fool plucked randomly off the street. We have plans for this man.
So what does it matter if he dies anyway? We can always start over.
What's that supposed to mean?
Well, what we are dealing with here is time travel, pure and simple, correct?
Time travel of a sort, yes.
So if this goes south, we go back a day, or an hour, or a week, and we activate the Matrans and bring the quantum interface online with the trawling guide, and use the same coordinates to lock onto his form. Then we bring him here again. Tanner is still there in Omaha alive, back in pastime. We fetch him a little earlier and there's no problem, okay?
Yeah. Try and think, will you?
I am thinking, and let me correct you on your misguided understanding of time trawling. There are no second chances. The variables are too great to allow us to make another attempt, no matter how much earlier we go back within the timeline.
The conversation had lost some of the urgency, growing more complicated and outlandish. Deciding he'd like to have a look at just who was parceling out the commentary on his fate, Tanner opened his eyes and saw he was surrounded by phantoms, ghosts, figures of white on white, as viewed from behind a distorting pane of glass. And that damnable breathing, his own breath, rasping in his ears like a blacksmith's bellows. Never a religious man, Tanner suddenly found himself in the presence of what appeared to be angels, and their presence fascinated him as much as it terrified him. For while the part of his magnificent mind that dwelt with philosophy took solace, the coldly scientific section of his brain was frightened. Angels were something he couldn't even begin to comprehend or explain. He closed his eyes tightly. Was he in heaven or hell? He didn't feel the kiss of hellfire, but he was at a loss how it was supposed to feel anyway. Regardless, he decided it was time to face his fears, and so Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner opened his eyes once more and found his vision blurred with tears.
He's awake again.
About time.
A man leaned over into Tanner's field of vision, a portly man with a wide face and a well-groomed black mustache. The eyes peering down were so dark they appeared to be the same color as the man's jet-black hair. The mouth beneath the mustache opened, casting forth a smell of garlic and tomato, as if the man had just eaten a particularly tangy salad and dressing.
Hello, Theo. How do you feel?
Do not...
I'm sorry?
Do not call me that.
Puzzled, the man consulted a black notebook, not turning beyond the first page.
It's your name, isn't it? Theo?
Only Only my beloved Emily calls me that.
Tenor wondered what had happened to his voice. The man frowned as he flipped pages in the compact book.
Emily. Emily, Emily. Help me here, somebody.